The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 396 of the Colombia Calling podcast. This week's very special guest will be Lina Beatriz Pinto Garcia. And we're talking about the rapid expansion of leishmaniasis, the tropical disease, that took place across Colombia and especially in the jungle areas. And it corresponds totally to the upturn in military activities and, the war, the conflict between the guerrillas and the Colombian armed forces. So a fascinating look at how an exponential increase in leishmaniasis started in the mid-1990s and 2000s when, let's say, the conflict theater in Colombia increased dramatically. So we'll be talking about that. And she's down in Jamundí, that's right near to Cali. And she'll be talking to us about the Diseased Landscapes Project. So that's done with Los Andes University, Oxford University, and other academic outfits as well. Well, you'll know that on Monday, most social media, aside from Twitter, I think, were down. So hence the delay on the Monday newscast this week for those subscribers out there. Not a lot we could do about that. With WhatsApp down, we couldn't send out the messages. But for those of you who have Signal or Telegram, we were able to send out the news updates. And we'll remind you all, of course, that for as little as $2 a month, you can subscribe to the Columbia Calling newscast reported by journalist Emily Hart. And it will arrive, WhatsApp permitting, to your WhatsApp accounts and anything else on Mondays. So I'm going to pass it over now to Emily Hart, and a thank you to all of you out there who continue to support us on Patreon. That's www.patreon.com/Columbia Calling. Thank you so much. We've had some great shows of late. Of course, Dr. Paula Cubillos last week with Hasta Siempre Colombia, which was a somber. It struck a somber tone, and people have written in about it. And of course, prior to that, Jordan Salama, the author, and prior to that, of course, Joshua Collins, a freelance journalist who is out in Catatumbo visiting and reporting on one of Colombia's, well, most complicated regions and coca cultivating regions. So very interesting shows. Next week, we've got an academic from Austin, Texas, Alexander Diamond, and he'll be talking about a documentary he made and some of the trouble that he got into, I think, making this documentary around the Caribbean coast. So please stay tuned. Anyway, I'm Richard McCall. This is episode 396. Over to Emily Hart with the news, and then on to the third segment with Dr. Lina Beatriz Pinto Garcia. So don't go away.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your top stories for the week of October 4th, 2021. A leak of more than 11.9 million confidential documents has brought to light the secret fortunes of some of the world's most influential people, including numerous members of the Colombian elite. Known as the Pandora Papers, the largest journalistic collaboration in history shines a light on the offshore industry, a world of trusts, shell companies, hidden beneficiaries, and powerful law firms in places like the British Virgin Islands or Panama. Offshore companies are generally used to hide ownership of assets and thereby exempt beneficiaries from tax or legal liability. The OECD estimates the equivalent of 27% of Latin America's financial wealth is siphoned off to offshore companies every year, amounting to $22 billion in lost taxes. Of the 35 presidents or former presidents who appear in the documents, 14 belong to this region. It has been revealed that 3 of the region's sitting heads of state and 11 former presidents have operated tax havens, along with more than 90 politicians and senior officials. The Colombian chapter of the Pandora Papers includes 588 owners of offshore companies. Among them are 2 former presidents, Andrés Pastrana and César Gaviria, as well as Colombia's richest man, Luis Carlos Sarmiento, 3 members of banking conglomerate dynasty the Hilinski family, and even Shakira. The majority claim that their assets were declared to the DIAN, Colombia's tax authority. However, according to the Pandora Papers, the current director of the DIAN, Lisandro Junco Ribeira, created a company in Delaware. He also reportedly has an account in Cyprus and a virtual office in London, managed through a Dubai-based provider. Also through a company in Panama, Angela Maria Orozco, Minister of Transport, and Marta Lucia Ramirez, Vice President, participated in a business deal in the British Virgin Islands with an investor who was convicted of money laundering. A former senator, governor of Antioquia, and mayor of Medellin, Luis Alfredo Ramos, has been sentenced to almost 8 years in prison for an illegal association with paramilitary groups, particularly with the AUC, the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, and its leaders, the Castaño brothers. A court determined that Ramos associated with paramilitary organizations for several years and placed public office at the service of those groups. Despite the conviction of Ramos and a criminal investigation against his son Esteban, the Ramos clan continues to have political influence, particularly in Medellin, where a second son is involved in mayoral politics. A conservative politician since the age of 22, Ramos was also head of debate for Ivan Duque's presidential campaign. He has been a key political ally of former President Álvaro Uribe. Uribe's own investigation for witness tampering recommences this week. The Supreme Court's investigation chamber concluded that, through third parties such as his former lawyer and a former congressman, Uribe had pressured witnesses to change their testimony about links between paramilitary groups and himself. Clashes between FARC dissidents and guerrilla group the ELN have displaced at least 250 people in Argelia, Cauca. In Argelia, this was the second mass displacement in September and the 14th in 2021. Renewed violence and armed conflict in Colombia forced more than 57,000 people to flee their homes between January and August this year. According to the United Nations, this is an increase of 135% compared to the same period in 2020. Colombia continues to report the highest number of internally displaced people worldwide. And in response to this new data, the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights made a special call to the Colombian state to strengthen the implementation of the peace agreement. They state that it constitutes an ideal tool to confront the structural causes of violence in the country. In international migration news, in Necoclí, Antioquia, the crisis continues. Around 20,000 migrants are stuck on the border with Panama, many from Haiti and Cuba, hoping to continue their journey north towards the USA. The emergency began at the end of July and has been worsened by a shortage of drinking water and basic sanitation. And coronavirus case numbers remain low, at around 1,500 new daily cases on average in Colombia. More than half the country has had one dose of vaccination, and a third are now fully vaccinated. Third doses will be administered where necessary, and the government has proposed incentives, including shopping discounts on VAT-free days for those with vaccination cards. And the economy is also showing signs of recovery from the pandemic. Unemployment in August was 12.3%, similar to that of March 2020, a month before the consequences of the pandemic started to be seen. The employment gap between men and women is also narrowing, though it is still high, at 7%. Those were your top stories from Colombia for this week. Thanks for listening.
And-
And we're back. This is episode 396 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Our very special guest this week is Dr. Lina Beatriz Pinto Garcia. She's a postdoctoral researcher at the CIDER, that's a division at Los Andes, a research division at Los Andes University in Bogota. And, well, Lina came to my attention through various people on Twitter and social media saying, you should get this person on. She's got some really fascinating investigations. And the one that caught my attention, and she's in Jamundi, so close to Cali in the southwest of Colombia right now. And what caught my attention is this, well, she does, it's called Diseased Landscapes. But let's, before we get into that, Lina, thank you so much for coming on the Columbia Calling podcast.
No, thank you so much for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here. And it's really cool to be able to share a little bit of what I do and who I am with all of your listeners.
Now,
so thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, and we are very lucky because Lina is about to have a baby in about 2 weeks, I think, or less.
Yeah.
So everyone out there is sending you the positive vibes and everything's great. And it's an amazing experience. There's nothing else like it. And we wish you all the best in this. And it's definitely a new phase in life because nothing is the same.
So, thank you so much.
You're most welcome. So, Lina, tell us a little bit, because you've been doing this Diseased Landscapes project, and I know it's with universities here in Colombia and Oxford University in England. Just tell us a bit about it, because, of course, it's all based on Colombia and leishmaniasis and tropical diseases and coca cultivations and everything that we need to hear about, you know, for those of us who are, I would say, Colombianists.
So I got into this project as a kind of something that started from my PhD research. Actually, during my PhD research, which I finished last year, already during the pandemic, I did an investigation on an ethnographic investigation on the relationship between cutaneous leishmaniasis and the Colombian armed conflict. And that part of this research, I conducted it in Tumaco, which is located on the Colombian Pacific coast, is actually the bordering municipality between Colombia and Ecuador. And at this particular place, I realized that most of the cases of leishmaniasis that I was having contact with, they were from people working in coca cultivation and coca crops and in processing coca for transforming coca into cocaine. So that was something that I kind of pointed out during my dissertation, but it's something that I didn't have the time and the scope also to analyze further. So that's why I decided to get into this Diseased Landscapes projects, mostly relating environmental health, agrarian extractivism, in this case of coca plantations and coca cultivation, and also coca eradication and how it relates to health problems for humans and also non-humans. So that's why we end up thinking about this project. We put it together in collaboration with INSIS, at Oxford University, which is the Institute for Science, Innovation and Society at Oxford, also with the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at King's College London, and CIDER, which is the Interdisciplinary Center for Development Studies at Universidad de Los Andes. So it's a very highly interdisciplinary project that, again, explores environmental and human health and how this relates to agrarian extractivism, in this case, coca cultivation, coca eradication, and also migration, because in this part, well, we are focusing on this time in El Catatumbo, which is this region, again, close to the border, but this time between Colombia and Venezuela. And in this region, Venezuelans coming like in large numbers to Colombia are being... They have become workers in these coca fields. So they are very, very much suffering from this disease. that we will, I guess, talk more about, because I probably no one knows what it is.
Well, first and foremost, I will never be forgiven if I don't tell you that my wife is doing her master's at Global Health at the University of London. So there you go. I'll never get away. And she's the most excited about this interview, because it's for her, it's fascinating, and she's explained some of the situations to me. But I want to know, I mean, you get into this and it's this agrarian extractivism, it's the, you know, the exploitation of these lands for coca, and then you've studied the area with Tumaco right on the border with Ecuador, and the area of Catatumbo, which actually we talked about a couple of podcasts ago with Joshua Collins, who was up there as a journalist visiting the coca fields. And so, of course, that's up on the Venezuelan border. So is this can't just be a border thing, but you've taken it into account on the borders. Because I'm sure in southwest Cauca and so on, there's leishmaniasis, but it's not border. But you've got a particularly interesting perspective from the borders, from the migration. And so it's Venezuelans coming through the Venezuelan border, but on the Ecuadorian border with Colombia, who are the people, the migrations there?
Actually, in Tumaco, is not well, yeah, there's migration from, there's a longer history probably on that, because of the war on drugs and the spraying of glyphosate in areas such as Putumayo and Caquetá. Many, many, many populations, like mostly mestizo populations, they ended up migrating to the Pacific coast, where most of the coca plantation had moved to since the 2000s. So the population that we see, they're affected by leishmaniasis because they work in these coca plantations, are mostly mestizos, not black populations who are like the kind of like the inhabitants par excellence of the Pacific coast. But in this case, it is mostly mestizo populations, campesinos who are now working in these coca fields and who have been displaced because of the war on drugs in Putumayo and Caquetá, and now live for some time now in areas like Tumaco. However, leishmaniasis is not necessarily a disease that is related only to migrants coming from one place to the other and settling there. Is mostly related, well, in Colombia, to the armed conflict in general, which also entails a lot of migration from combatants. And that's why they take the disease from one place to another. But maybe it's a coincidence that I have been in these two places that are border places, although leishmaniasis is mostly a disease that is related to jungle areas, to the selva. So that's why, although in many, many countries in Latin America face this health problem, in Colombia, it is characteristic and particular that the disease has a strong, very strong attachment to the war, because these jungles, the selvas, have been the main theater of war in Colombia, and that's why combatants of the state, so soldiers, but also paramilitaries and guerrillas, they have been the populations most affected by this disease. So that was actually the focus of my earlier work, let's say. And now I related that to mostly to civilians working on coca cultivation, which is also, of course, very much entangled with the armed conflict, but from a little bit of a different perspective than combatants, right?
Yeah, definitely. But it's okay. It's about we need to explain to my listeners, most of whom I believe will know what leishmaniasis is, but we need to explain it. Explain it for me. It's about one of the few tropical diseases I haven't had. Okay? I'm not going to joke about it. I've had typhoid, dengue, hemorrhagic dengue, malaria. I can't remember what else I've had. But anyway, tell us about leishmaniasis.
So leishmaniasis is, there are two major forms of leishmaniasis. There's cutaneous leishmaniasis and visceral leishmaniasis. In Colombia, the most prevalent form of the disease, although we have both, the most prevalent form of the disease, so the 98% of leishmaniasis cases in Colombia is cutaneous leishmaniasis. So it's a disease that affects the skin. Once you have been bitten by a sandfly, which is a tiny, tiny insect that lives in the jungle, and this tiny insect transmits a microscopic parasite that is called leishmania, the leishmania parasite. And this parasite leads to the formation of ulcers on the skin of lesions that start growing, and they are not that painful, but they bother you. They look kind of very disgusting, and they, in certain cases, they expand, so they grow like into the depth of the skin and also, how to say it, like on the surface of the skin, forming this like circular lesions that don't heal. That's the problem with the disease. They resist healing, so they don't form a scar very easily, and they do need pharmaceuticals. The other type of the disease that I was telling you about, that is visceral leishmaniasis, is not very common in Colombia. It's restricted to some very specific areas, and is not like a major public health issue here, while it is a major issue in countries like Brazil and India, for example. But not in Colombia. In Colombia, the disease I have been studying, and also the disease that is related to the conflict and to coca plantations, for example, is cutaneous leishmaniasis. So when I say leishmaniasis, I'm referring actually to cutaneous, to the cutaneous form, which is this skin form of the disease that is not deadly. Well, the visceral form can be deadly. The cutaneous form is not deadly. So you never die from that. But it's very annoying to have it, and especially if you have like a lesion that never scars over, so you have it all the time raw and open, and sometimes like smelling badly because of additional infections because of bacteria and fungi, then you start worrying about it and you feel you need desperately treatment to get this thing to heal.
So, it looks like, and from what I understand and the pictures that I've seen, it's just this open wound that just keeps on, kind of as if you were sort of burning the edges of paper and it was, you know, receding. And then you remain horribly disfigured, right? I mean, is there a way?
It depends. Okay. Like, for some people, it can just be like a tiny circular thing that doesn't grow that much. For some others, it can grow a lot, and then it becomes super scary and something that worries you a lot in your daily life. For some other people, for example, the parasites can migrate to the mucosal membranes. That's why they also talk about mucosal leishmaniasis, which is when the parasites move to the nose or the mouth, and then this can lead to the mutilations, disfigurations of the face. But this also happens in very rare cases. It's like 4% in Colombia. It's very small percentage compared to the people who just have like the skin lesions, or usually in parts of the body that are always exposed, like the arms or the legs, where the sandflies have access to our skin to bite us. But the fact that it can eventually maybe lead to this larger problems or more concerning problems, such as like the migration of parasites to the mouth, nose, throat, then that worries a lot of people, and that information kind of makes part of our understanding of the disease in the country and also how we deal about it.
And the cure is just incredibly strong antibiotics on a drip, a suero or something like that?
That is like a huge part of my research, because the treatment that is used to deal with leishmaniasis in Colombia, so the what is called the first line therapy, so the standard treatment that is used for that, it's called glucanthime. It is a treatment that was developed in the 1940s, actually very long time ago in the context of the Second World War. And glucanthime in particular is produced by Sanofi, this large pharmaceutical company from France. And it's an extremely toxic medicine that can even lead to death, even though the disease is not deadly. So as you can imagine, like one of the populations that are most affected by this disease are soldiers of the Colombian military. And kind of they have a very privileged access to this treatment compared to other populations in rural areas of Colombia, like guerrillas and civilians. They don't have easy access to these drugs. And I can also explain why. But the fact that soldiers get privileged access to this drug is also concerning, because it is such a toxic treatment that you get it so much into, like, injected into your bodies, that soldiers also end up suffering from violence because of repetitive treatment with this drug that has been used for years by the army in order to put soldiers back over and over again into the selva and make them like part of this war machine that never stops. So yeah, the treatment is a super concerning part of the issue. And also, according, for example, according to some people from the guerrillas, it's kind of like the link that holds together leishmaniasis and the armed conflict is the treatment. And this is so, or they say so, because, as I was saying, the glucan-10, this injectable drug, is controlled 100% by the state and is not made available to the people in rural areas that actually need it. It's controlled in a way that those who have access to it are mostly soldiers of the Colombian army, while guerrillas and civilians have suffered almost insurmountable barriers to access this treatment. So it has been weaponized as a strategy to harm guerrillas. And as is common in Colombia with the armed conflict, the ones who end up suffering most from this policies and practices and regulations are civilians, because guerrillas, anyway, they are very powerful, or they have been, or they were very powerful actors in rural Colombia, and they managed through black market and smuggling to get access to the drug. But civilians are just in a limbo there.
Kind of collateral damage on this one. This is where the phrase you use in one of your essays, the pharmaceuticalization of the conflict in Colombia. And I can jump in with some anecdotes there, because when I was in Medellin in hospital many, many years ago, being treated for, I don't know what, there was the malaria, they made me sign documents that I would not sell the drugs on. And it did say like to, you know, illegal groups and stuff. And of course, I wasn't going to, because I needed the drugs, but it did strike me as evil. It's kind of biological warfare in that way. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that I have a friend who studied with me on my doctorate, who's a captain in the army, and he spent lots of time in the jungles in the south. Putumayo, Caquetá, I think he was in Norte Santander quite a bit. You know, someone who's been a career military officer. And he said there were times where the guerrillas were so good at getting through the jungle that they would lead soldiers deliberately on fake paths and fake pathways into areas where they knew there were the sandflies that had leishmaniasis. Of course, the guerrillas would know they had their way out, but they would lead the soldiers into these areas, because a soldier gets leishmaniasis and you take him out of the conflict, the theater, as you said, you know. And I found that incredible, because again, it's another angle of this biological warfare, using nature in this way. And I've never forgotten it. I mean, I forget a lot of things, but I've never forgotten that, because it really resonated with me. It's like, wow, look at this. And so, I mean, I just find it's so confusing, but so clear at the same time. And I don't know how I feel about the state controlling medicines. I don't know how I feel about that. I'm sure I'll get jumped on by my trolls for saying that. But and then you have another phrase referring to this. It's referred to, leishmaniasis has been referred to as a subversive disease. So, of course, it's a disease that the guerrillas get, or that people in I don't know, illicit groups get because they spend their times in the jungles. But of course, it's not a subversive disease. It's a disease that affects everyone, but everyone who is involved in these areas. And so your research, which is fascinating when we look at the diseased landscapes, is not only putting the guerrillas, not only putting the soldiers, but when you're talking about the civilians working in the coca fields, so they are more exposed to it. What have been your findings? Because, of course, you've been down to Tumaco and you've been to Catatumbo for these things. As you said, it's ethnographic. What has been the experiences amongst these people? Have you seen people suffering from the leishmaniasis? Have you talked to them about their work and so on?
Yeah, I was a lot in places like Tumaco. I have been less able to be to places to Catatumbo because of my pregnancy, but I have like very nice co-workers and colleagues doing the field work for us, Juan Camilo Montoya and Alejandro Cañizares. So they are part of our research team. And what we have found so far is that there is a state discourse that, at least in Catatumbo, this is how this seems to be working, is that the state the public health institutions, they have difficulties to enter areas that are, and to work in areas that are very much affected by the conflict still, and even worse now, in this quote-unquote post-conflict phase. And at the same time, this leads to an invisibility of the relationship between leishmaniasis, for example, and coca plantations, because these are zones where it is hard to... So it's a disease that in general is underreported, but especially like if you have a lot of conflict and violence going on, it's very hard for people to move to health centers, to hospitals, to get this... whatever they have, like the lesion checked and see if it's leishmaniasis or not, and then get treatment. Also for Venezuelans, well, there's another level of complexity because they are not covered by our healthcare system. They are only covered as long as they have a health problem that is considered an urgency or an emergency. So what happens in these areas is sometimes, for example, health workers help Venezuelans to pass a leishmaniasis lesion as an urgency, even if it's not, just for help them to get some access to diagnosis and treatment. And what also happens is that the state is kind of, in a way, blind to the problem, and they mostly talk about how leishmaniasis is related, for example, to coffee plantations in southern areas of the departamento of Norte de Santander, where there's no conflict and they have more access to the populations and to cases and so on. But that produces this kind of biased picture of the problem that doesn't account for the ways in which conflict, coca, migrants come together and are entangled in this issue. In the case of, I also wanted to mention in relation to what you were saying before, I think it's important to mention that the military and the guerrillas, they both think, or many of them think, that leishmaniasis was actually used as a biological weapon, that this was, for example, guerrillas, they think that the military released this disease into the jungle in order to harm them. And the military, they think it was guerrillas who somehow liberated the parasite into the jungle in order to affect them. The truth is that this disease has been in South America before the Spanish came here. Okay. So it's been a disease that has always been there. So there's no kind of a release of a parasite as you would imagine in a biological war, for example. There's no like engineering of a parasite or of a pathogen in order to harm the other group, but that doesn't mean that it's not been, or that it hasn't been used as in a strategic ways in order to harm the other. So the most visible aspect of this is what I was mentioning earlier, like the control, the restrictive control on the treatment that ends up harming guerrillas and civilians and dogs. We can also talk about that. But as you said, I've also heard, for example, there was an article or a written piece, I think it was in El Tiempo from the 90s. Like, I found it once, I read it, I thought it was fascinating, and then I lost it, and I have never been able to find it again. But it said something like that, how guerrillas used to lead troops of the Colombian military into certain areas where they knew there was a lot of sandflies, and they just waited, you know, until, like, without shooting or using any gun, they just waited there. And then the military started evacuating one soldier after the other, until the military weren't there anymore because of leishmaniasis, because the military considers this disease a professional disease or an occupational disease. They are obligated, although they don't do it timely, but they are obligated to evacuate soldiers for them to access diagnosis and treatment in some other place far away from the jungle, right? So that was super interesting. And I also heard, for example, how they have done it with snakes. Like, they know certain areas where snakes are living, and they know that a lot of snake bites are going to happen in certain places. So they kind of make the army to concentrate in those areas because they know, like, snakes are going to do the job for them. So it's really, really interesting what is going on there. And also, like, this, all these technological devices that kind of the military and guerrillas have come to in order to address the problem, that is also fascinating for me. I can talk more about it if you want. Yeah.
But I didn't think about the snakes. I mean, I guess there are areas that are, well, you know, more inhabited, populated by snakes, and therefore, yeah, you could send people. I'd never thought about that at all. I mean, leishmaniasis. I think we need to sort of get some other basics out there. Is the figures then for leishmaniasis in Colombia? And you've mentioned, okay, so they talk about the leishmaniasis in the coffee cultivations in sort of, let's say, lower or more southern regions of Norte Santander, or and not in the coca regions. So therefore, the figures are inaccurate for cases of leishmaniasis, which of course then allows the government to play a different game. And I mean, do we have any figures of recent cases and percentages? I mean, do we know how prevalent this is? Because I mean, it's almost like a leishmaniasis, not to belittle it a bit, it's like a horror film, isn't it? I mean, this sort of thing.
Well, it depends. Actually, for some people, it's something you can live with for many years, and it's so common in rural areas that for some, and it has many different names in rural areas. So, for example, in the Pacific, they call it guaral, and in most of the country, they call it pito. So it's, and that's also very confusing because pito is also the way to call Chagas disease, which is a very different, also vector-borne, but it still is a very different disease. And there's a lot of confusion there that we can also talk about. But the figures, as I said, like, there's a huge problem of underreporting in general in the world, because as I was saying, like, some people just live with that. And in some cases, it just heals. You know, you're like, your immune system is able to fight the disease and lead to the healing process of the body. So you don't need any treatment. But in other cases, it can become very bad. So the people who end up kind of approaching healthcare institutions and those cases that get counted or that figure in the public health databases of the National Institute of Health are just a small portion of the real cases out there. Of course, for example, guerrillas at a certain point, especially when it became very tough for them to leave the selva and go to see a doctor in a health center, or like, guerrilla cases, of course, are underreported. Like, they don't often go to health centers. They try to deal with, at least that was with when the FARC was operating, they try to deal with their own health problems within the organization, and they avoided a lot to leave the jungle. It would have to be a very extreme case when they allow people to leave the jungle in order to check what was going on with their health in a health center hospital or somewhere outside the jungle. So there's also the other component that you were also talking about, because this disease is stigmatized as a guerrilla disease or as a subversive disease. People are very afraid in certain areas of the country to let others know that they have leishmaniasis. And this can be in some areas of the country, there's no stigmatization very much working on, while in others, for example, where the FARC had an important presence, in those areas, the stigmatization works very hard. So they are super afraid to get in touch with medical professionals or with health workers, because they don't want them to think they are guerrillas. And this information, in some cases, ends up reaching the military, the police, and then they start being targeted as guerrilla members. Also, in some, which is very, like one of those things that you live in Colombia and that you don't believe about it, but it's in the midst of this violence that has become so everyday thing for us. In some of the testimonies that paramilitaries provided during the their demobilization process, so in the scope of the La Ley de Justicia y Paz, there are some testimonies of paramilitaries saying that leishmaniasis marks on the body were one of the many criteria they used to decide if someone was a guerrilla member or not, and then to proceed practicing violence on this person, like killing them. Or so it's like leishmaniasis marks on the body have been actually used to kill people and to affect people and to harm people. And this is very paradoxical in the sense, again, that this is not even a deadly disease. So you end up dying. It's kind of like the social construction of a non-deadly disease into a deadly one because of the stigma. So again, like the figures are super confusing, are not reliable, but people for very, very long time, they talked about 14,000 cases in Colombia every year. Then in moments where the war was more intense, they talked about 20,000 cases a year. And one of the records we have is that in the mid of the 2000s, mid-2000s, we had like a huge peak of leishmaniasis cases. This also talks about how the military strategy during Álvaro Uribe's government changed in dramatic ways, became like the recruitment of soldiers increased by more than 30%. Soldiers were asked not just to enter the selva and leave it, but go to the selva and stay there for several months. And these were populations that many of them were kind of naive to leishmaniasis, so they had never had contact with the vector or the parasite, so they became very easily vulnerable to the disease. And then the military had like a peak of cases, a large epidemic in the mid-2000s, and that's why leishmaniasis at this point, especially in the history of our conflict, it was during Álvaro Uribe's government that leishmaniasis turned into a major problem for the military and a major problem for the state in order to keep going with this war. And they had to solve it somehow. So it became even more stigmatization on one side, more control of the treatment on the other side, more provision of treatment for soldiers in a very, I would say, non-responsible way. And the problem in general became more acute, and the numbers also higher.
Amazing. And yet these numbers will be less than the actual numbers, won't they? I mean, that's the thing. You talk about a spike at 20,000 or so, but it's going to be much higher because, of course, the people from those regions aren't included, the guerrillas aren't included. It's amazing. And so can we conclude, and there's a dangerous word, in academic fields, but that the conflict led to the extension of the conflict and the intensification of the Colombian conflict led to an increase in cases of leishmaniasis?
We can safely say that.
Okay, good.
I think that's part of what my research shows, that it was especially during this time in the mid 2000s that the problem became a major problem, became also like, I talk about these 14,000 cases or 20,000 cases, when you compare that to other diseases, for example, malaria, that is another vector-borne disease that is very much prevalent in Colombia, the numbers of malaria are much higher. So, and because malaria, for example, is a deadly disease, the state has like a huge concern for malaria, and to do things like the malaria strategy is kind of bold in Colombia. Like there are, for example, community volunteers who are trained to diagnose malaria in very remote areas of the country, and also they provide treatment to these people. While leishmaniasis is a disease that has much, like the numbers, the figures are much more smaller. It's not a deadly thing. So kind of as a public health worker told me, like the state can afford not to do anything. You know, you don't have people dying from that. It's not like one of those things that turns on alarms in the international public health institutions. It's something that you can just don't care about and still harm a lot of people while doing that. During the most acute years of the war, during the mid-2000s, it is remarkable how this became a thing for the state. So it was a thing before, but it was a minor thing. But then when it created lots of problems for the army and for being able to ensure domination and presence in areas they have fought for, and they were losing it because of leishmaniasis. Like also, I remember an officer of the army telling me, like, for example, you go to an area that is endemic for leishmaniasis and you enter there with a large like group of people, 200 something. And then because of leishmaniasis, then in a couple of weeks you have 180, and then you have 150, and then you have 130, and then you don't have like a battalion anymore. And then you end up losing whatever you have fought for in the war. And that became a major thing during Uribe's time. So that's why they created in 2005 El Centro de Recuperación de la Leishmaniasis, which is the Center for Leishmaniasis Recovery, also called sometimes Center for Leishmaniasis Rehabilitation, which is located within the Silva Plazas Battalion that is located in Duitama in Boyacá. And it is a clinic, basically, that is devoted to exclusively treat leishmaniasis in active soldiers of the army. So huge was the problem that they had to create infrastructures and procedures in order to deal with that. And there's no other disease or condition that received that exclusive and so elaborated attention within the army. For example, there's no malaria recovery center, or right? Like there's like this thing that is called with a specific name of a disease, and that the whole, and that's also part of what I did during my PhD research. I was many months in this center looking at the experience of soldiers going through treatment of leishmaniasis and how they experienced
that. You were there in the base in Duitama.
Yeah. Wow. I was like for 3-4 months there.
Wow.
In 2016, 2017. And that was amazing also because for the army, the center, which is called the CRL, the Leishmaniasis Recovery Center, it's a source of pride, you know? It's one of those things that they think is kind of like, it's sometimes picture as a good legacy of the war, like that the leishmaniasis program within the military is exemplary for other countries. It's exemplary in the ways they are organized and how they treat all these soldiers against this disease that is a neglected tropical issue and so on. And then when I was there and I realized what I was telling you at the beginning, like how cruel it is that they put soldiers under repetitive cycles of treatment because they need soldiers to put them back into the jungle as soon as possible. So they treat them over and over and over with a thing soldiers themselves call poison. So it's really, really worrying and sad and cruel.
But an incredibly important piece of research to have been in there and to have viewed it, perhaps not from a medical background, from an ethnographic one. I think that's, you know, because we can look at stats and we can look at the drug that's used, but to have been there amongst the soldiers and then amongst the campesinos or the coca growers or the people, I guess the raspachines, the guys who pick the coca leaves for them. Wow, it's an intense experience, this.
Very intense, yeah.
So what, you know, we have to wind this down, unfortunately, because I think we could talk for hours. I think we're in an inverted commas post-conflict situation with, you've got the ex-combatants from the FARC, and then you've got dissident FARC, and then you've got the other illegal groups, and then you've got the sort of post-paramilitary groups or newly armed groups or whatever they're called now, the Clan del Golfo and others. You've got Venezuelans in search and desperate need of jobs, so they're ending up in these places, and we've got more coca cultivation. Was it less coca cultivation than before, but more cocaine production, I think it is. So, I mean, this isn't going away. Leishmaniasis is here to stay. What are your thoughts to sort of close this conversation? What are your thoughts for the future on this?
Well, right now, in the scope of the project we are doing, we're asking ourselves the same question, like how this would inform policy making in a context of post-conflict, and how do we have to understand the relationship between health and conflict in order to come up with better solutions to the problem. I think leishmaniasis, even though again it's a minor disease, it's an emblematic case to kind of disentangle what this relationship between war and health has been in Colombia. And it's an emblematic case, also very illustrative to understand what kinds of problems there might be in rural areas of the country that need to be solved urgently in order to think about how we repurpose healthcare for peace building, and how we organize healthcare and public health, because part also of what I have shown with my research is that areas such as biomedical research, like what scientists do in labs and so on, and public health have participated in the production of violence through the case leishmaniasis is a case that shows how biomedical research and public health can have a participation in the production of violence in the context of an armed conflict like the Colombian one. And I think those are areas, for example, that people don't imagine as being participant in a warfare, or you don't think that scientists might be in a way participating in this whole issue, and they are, even from good intentions and from trying to do their best, but they end up entangled, as I say, enmarañados, which is like a concept that I develop in my research, in this whole issue, even if you are not aware of that, or even if you don't want to, but they end up there. So what should be done? I think, well, in terms of Venezuelans, I think there are many people thinking about this right now, like how the work, for example, of Natalia Acevedo, she has been studying how healthcare professionals, they are key in order to make the access of healthcare services for Venezuelans happen in Colombia, even though they don't have access to them, according to regulations, only, as I said, if they are emergencies. And what we are documenting now is that they have a great need of diagnosis and treatment for leishmaniasis and many other diseases and health conditions. So that needs to change. Also, the criminalization of people working in coca plantations has also led to not considering leishmaniasis as a professional disease or occupational disease, as it is considered in the army. And they are like these people and that suffering from these diseases, such as leishmaniasis, because of the work they are forced to do, because they live in very marginal or in a very marginalized condition and under poverty, and they are forced to work in this coca field. And that's why they end up having the disease. So we need also to start thinking of leishmaniasis in ways that account for how it is related to certain occupations and how we need to stop criminalizing those occupations that people engage with because of the poverty they are facing or their different problems they are facing. And of course, we need to provide treatment for everyone who needs it. And question also our policy of treatment. Like, as I said, the treatment is terribly harmful and toxic. So we need to reconsider what other alternatives we have in order to treat this disease. And there are some alternatives, but they are not made available. So we need to kind of rethink the whole public health strategy on leishmaniasis and stop making it a pharmaceuticalized policy that is based strongly and only on Glucanthime, on this very toxic treatment. We need to move beyond that and provide other alternatives to the people suffering from this disease.
More inclusive healthcare plan for these isolated, marginalized areas. Thank you so much for that. I've been absolutely, you've informed me beyond what I possibly ever knew on leishmaniasis and the regions in Colombia. And I know it's not an easy time for you right now. And I'm so very appreciative for your time, because this has been totally fascinating. I'm now going to go and repeat almost everything you've told me to my wife and keep her informed, because thank you so much for your time on this one. And I will point people in the direction of your academic articles and so on, because it is an important one, because it's, as you say, repurposing healthcare for peace building. And I think in that concept, it's all encompassing, really. So let me take this moment to thank you, Dr. Lina Beatriz Pinto Garcia, for your time today and coming on the Columbia Calling podcast. It's been a real pleasure.
No, thank you so much again for the invitation. Like, I can talk about this for hours and hours. So, and I love to do it, and I love to share my work. And so thank you so much for the invitation. And I hope that more people get interested about these issues and how we can think of areas like health that do not seem too related to our violence problems, but they are.
Yeah, totally related. So, thank you again, everyone, for listening. This has been episode 396 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I've been Richard McCall talking to Dr. Lina Pinto Garcia. Please always, spread the word about the podcast, share it all over the place. We're trying to get word and news about Columbia out there that goes beyond what's just in the headlines here, in our mainstream press. Thank you again, and goodbye, everyone.